welcome to SOS Stories of Service, the BSWSS Student Society's social work interview show. I'm your host, Kayla.
And I'm Geraldine.
And welcome to our first episode. Before we get started on what today's episode is on, we are first one to do the land acknowledgement.
We would like to acknowledge that we are gathered on the traditional and unceded territory of the Algonquin Anishinaabe Nation. As we engage in discussions on social work and service, we recognize the enduring presence, knowledge, and contributions of the Algonquin people. We commit to fostering awareness, respect, and meaningful action toward reconciliation and social justice.
So on today's episode, our focus is Black Voices, as it is Black History Month, and we want to celebrate Black achievements as well as Black history, especially in the social work field, and what it means to be Black, as well as other intersecting of identities when it comes to being in the social work practice and field. So for our first guest, we are going to have if you would like to give like a brief introduction of who you are, what you do in practice, and what is your area of practice in particular.
Okay. Well, thank you, Kayla and
Geraldine.
And Geraldine for inviting me. So what do I do in practice? So I'm a clinical social worker. And so what that means is that I work with individuals, couples, families, groups, and supporting their mental health, and also helping them navigate the system in terms of like navigating like support that they may need, resources and things like that. I have been in this field for a while now, and ask me how long, but it's an interesting field. As a social worker right now, I am currently in my second year of PhD, of the social work PhD in the social work program. So,
awesome, amazing. So, our first question is, describe your pathway in social work field and how your identity has shaped your area of interest in particular.
Okay, so that's a good question. My pathway to social work. So it wasn't very linear. My undergrad was in psychology in Montreal. And after graduating from psychology, I took a couple of years off, traveled a little bit, and then I came back and actually worked in corporate Canada. I worked as a online specialist, like a campaign online specialist in Toronto. I was doing all of that and it was really good, but I just knew that it really wasn't my scene. It wasn't for me. I preferred doing like work with people, and that kind of work was very, it was just working on a computer, working with numbers. Numbers is not my thing. Talking to people about their campaign and how their clicks and keywords are doing online, I was just like, okay. It was good for a while. The money was good and all of that. So after working on a couple of years, I left and then did some more traveling, got married, then decided that, you know what, I want to go back into what I really was passionate about, like really what drew me to psychology, which was really service and helping people. Mm-hmm. And so I did experience some discrimination around like applying into like the psychology program for masters. Then it was really it was hard for a lot of Black people to get into those programs. A lot of times people would travel or go to other countries or travel out to do their master's or PhD program. So anyways, I decided to pivot into social work. I've been drawn into social work for a while, and finally I yielded the like clarion call to do it. And so I started it, and it's been good so far. So I did my bachelor's, did my master's, and then was working in the field and decided to come back and do my PhD.
It's definitely been a journey.
It has been a journey, but it's a big one. I won't give it up for the world. It was really good, the process I took.
Exactly. And you said that you traveled. Where was like your favorite place you went?
Trinidad and Tobago.
Mm. Yes. Yep, the Caribbean.
Yeah, yep. So I was there for a while. It was one of my favorite people. They were really nice people. They were really good. They became family. I was there for 4 years. It was interesting. It was
That's amazing. Beautiful. The second question that we've got together is, how does your identity hinder but also support the work you do?
Okay, so I'll start with how it is supported, right? First of all, I'm a Black woman, as we know. I'm a woman. I'm an immigrant, and so having those intersections, mm-hmm. right, helps me to support clients who are maybe from the same community as I'm at or from, or even if they're not my community, but just having that lived experience of, let's say, immigration, having a lived experience as a woman, as a Black woman, you know, and all these various intersections really does help me provide the kind of support that is that really centers the needs of the people I'm working with. It gives me a different perspective as well. I come in with a, understanding that there are some groups that are marginalized, and there are some groups that are, and these marginalized groups are also experiencing like systemic barriers and things like that. So having that knowledge already just gives me a different, I feel like it gives me an upper hand in how I approach these people, how I support them. And so that's how my identity has supported like my work. How it has hindered it as well is that there's, you know, for Black people, not that it's growing, but there's a lot of Black people in this field. But what we tend to notice is that there's a lot of burnout. We experience a lot of burnout. We experience a lot of sort of feeling like we have to know the knowledge, we have to know it, and we have to teach people mm-hmm. what to do and how to how to present themselves to us or to the world. You deal with racism as well. You deal with other systemic barriers. You deal with having to always be one or two steps ahead of your peers, mm-hmm. right? As a person of color. And so that's some of the, you know, the downfalls of this process for me. But I'm one person that even if I have experience, like even if I know these barriers exist, I see them as like a stepping stone to like whatever it is that I want to achieve. Like I know that they're there, and I'm not ignorant of that they exist. But at the same time, I do not allow them to stop me from doing the work that I have to
do. So you build resilience.
So I build resilience, and also my community. I make sure that I have people around me. But I really, and your mindset, you have to have like in doing this work, you have to have a growth mindset. You have a mindset that, you know, if you see all the challenges and all the difficulties, and you will get discouraged, like mm-hmm. seriously and quickly, yes. you will get discouraged. However, you have to remember what brought you into this in the first place. Why did you decide to do this, right? And so if you can remember that your reasons for doing this, it can really help propel you, it can really help keep you centered in your work. And so that's the way I look at it, and that's why I'm still here.
That's amazing.
That's
a great response.
Yeah. I really liked what you touched on about feeling the need to educate others, especially mm-hmm. on like racialized issues or the Black community in general. I feel like I personally like experience that as well, like in yeah. classes, as like it's not a predominantly white-centered field of social work, I've noticed as well. So having to educate people on your experience, it sometimes can be frustrating, and you always feel like you need to give.
And you know, sometimes I have to tell you, I tell them like, go and read. It's not my role to like educate you, right? It's not my job. It's not my role. So, but the truth is, sometimes we. You know, it's coming out of a place of wanting to share knowledge, of love, or you know, respect for your identity of who you are. You want to share that, but at the same time, it takes a toll on you, right? Because if you want to know about other people, you go and study about them, and then when you want to know about me, you want me to educate you. Like, and also, I'm not the holder of this knowledge. It's out there for everyone to know. So, you know, go out and find out what you need to know. If you have questions, I can answer those questions.
But you're still in the process of learning yourself. You can't expect to be able to answer every question.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I'm not the expert in Black women and immigrant Black women. Like mm-hmm. there's so many of us. Like yeah.
And how would you say like instilling those boundaries, being like, no, go read about it. How do you feel like that? Those interactions have occurred, and like how do you feel people have reacted to you saying those boundaries?
You know, that's a good question. And in the beginning, you start off feeling. Anxious. You're anxious, you're nervous, you know, you don't want to push people away, and you don't want to come across as this stereotype, right? Mm-hmm. As a, you know, a Black angry woman, right? And mm-hmm. and so people already, when you tell them, like, you know, go and do it for yourself, it doesn't matter how soft you say it to them or how calm you are, they just, you know, interpret it as like you're being mean and you don't want to help, right? Mm-hmm. However, I realized that people are actually projecting their own insecurities on me. And so I'm like, no, right? And so as you continue in this field, you start to understand, okay, when I go home, I realize that I'm feeling depleted. I'm tired. And then I start to take count of, like recount my day and realize that it was this conversation that really brought me to that point. Mm-hmm. So when I detach myself from those kinds of conversations, I realize that I'm okay. So for me, that's like knowledge that this is creating stress. It's depleting me. It's weathering me. So, and I don't want that to continue to happen. So how do I approach this? And the truth is that I'm here to support those who need the support, but like if you know how to read, if you are a scholar, if you know all of these things, then it's out there for you to go and get them. So do that. Mm-hmm. But it's not on me to carry that on for you. It's not on me, and I will not take on that role. If I'm feeling guilty, if I'm feeling whatever I'm feeling, I will deal with my feelings later, but I will stand on my principles. And as time goes on, those feelings dissipate, and instead you get empowered, so.
Glad to hear. Our next question kind of focuses more on your work with Black men and mm-hmm. schizophrenia. So what approach when working with Black men in the Black community, how does it differ in comparison to other groups in particular?
It's my reason for going into this area is based on my experience, so my personal experience. And not to go into the personal part of it, but something of course we have read about and we notice is that there's this whole stereotype around like Black men and masculinity and what society expects of them, mm-hmm. for them to always be strong, for them to always show up this way, and a lot of times it takes a toll on them. They don't have spaces to be vulnerable. They don't have spaces to talk about what they're going through. And so I, of course, in my community and also in my personal life, I do have Black men who share that same sentiments as well. And so I noticed that if they're struggling with a serious mental health illness, they tend to hide it. They won't seek support. And instead, it creates more, more barriers for them, more struggles for them. And so intentionally creating a space or creating an avenue or creating something that can help them to open up about their struggles, I think, is what's important. And so my reason also for going into talking about like those struggling with schizophrenia or psychosis is also back to that sort of taboo topic, right? Like these are things that you don't talk about because you're scared of being labeled as crazy, as mad, as all of these things. And so they don't express their what they're going through, and therefore don't receive support the way they need to receive that support, and so they continue to struggle. So in listening to their stories and talking to them, then I can understand, okay, from their perspective, what the struggles are, what their barriers are, what their experiences are, and then from their perspective with the services that they've received from social work, I can then understand, okay, have they been receiving culturally responsive care, right? It's not really about being competent, because that, yes, that word is there and is important, but I don't know if I would expect a white social worker to be competent, culturally competent in supporting this man. But instead, I would expect you to be culturally responsive. And so sometimes what that means is saying, I don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. I'd rather like bring someone else in just, you know, to support me in the kind of work so that I can provide you with the kind of care that you need. So I don't know if I answered your question with that. I feel like I went on a tangent, but that's the reason for my going into this, into working with Black. Yeah.
That's totally fine that you went. Like, your responses are just how you like are thinking about it. So yes. Any response that you give is valid.
And honestly, we're just in awe. You mentioned kind of like how people are able to kind of better understand people through identity and such. For example, like a white social worker being to fully understand what a Black male social worker. How is that kind of relationship as you are a Black woman and them being vulnerable with you in a sense? How does that work? What are their kind of reactions to talking with you and such?
You know, and that's a good question, because one thing I've noticed, especially in my practice, is that whenever a Black man would come in and speak to me, a lot of times they are going through things that they don't feel comfortable sharing with maybe another Black man either, because back to that stereotype of masculinity and men don't cry, men are not allowed to be vulnerable, right? And so coming to speak to another Black person, sometimes they feel that they'll be judged. They feel like not being open to, like they can't open up about things like this because the person won't really understand. But coming to a Black woman, coming to a Black woman maybe makes them feel more comfortable, mm-hmm. right? It's like, I'm not speaking to my mom, but seeing someone that's like, kind of like my mom, mm-hmm. and who will understand and who will allow me to express myself emotionally and stuff. And I feel like my identity as a Black woman really does create a safe space for them. Mm-hmm. Right? It's all about safety. It's all about being mindful. It's all mm-hmm. about being vulnerable. It's all about like allowing them show up the way they need to show up in a, mm-hmm. in a space like this. And so I really try my best to provide those kinds of a safe space that allows them to express what they're going through and of course to receive the support that they need.
The next question that we have is, how do generational trauma, racism, and ideas of masculinity shape the mental health experiences of Black men? And you've answered some of it, mm-hmm. But more specifically, like, have you like analyzed what are the specific things that could be in contact with the experiences that Black men face within their mental health? Like, what kind of triggers that to occur?
Yeah, that's a good point, because a lot of times they're told to, like, they hide. They don't want to speak about what they're going through, right? Mm-hmm. Just going back to that same rhetoric that they hear about, like, Black men don't cry, Black people don't deal with mental health, there's no mental health in the Black community, right? And they're supposed to be the provider, the supporter, mm-hmm. all of these things. And so seeking help and experiencing mental health or depression, all of that, it just feels foreign to them. And so even if they are experiencing it, a lot of times they would either hide it or they would, you know, just avoid, ignore, or just say that, you know what, this is not something that they're experiencing, and it's understandable. So how do I then sort of support that process? What I do is that, of course, I try to go back to the beginning and say, you know what, I know that there is this societal, society's like construction around like masculinity. Mm-hmm. I know that men are not supposed to cry. I know all of these things. I know that you have to be strong. You have to be emotionally resilient. You have to be all of these things. And also you can be all of that, but you can be soft. You can be vulnerable. You can be weak, because the truth is, we are both weak and strong as human beings, period. It's not even a thing of a Black person or white person, whatever. We all are weak in areas as well. So if you're experiencing weakness in different areas, especially when it comes to your mental health, if you're able to seek support and get the kind of support that you need, then you will feel better. A lot of times they are worried that they will not get the kind of support they need, because the truth is the services out there sometimes, because mostly women are the ones usually seeking help and asking for help. So a lot of those supports sometimes cater for women. And so when they go in, it almost feels like they're using the same assessment or work that they would use for a woman, and they have to like tweak it, right? Which I don't think is good. I think that there should be a protocol for them with an experience, tailoring it to their experiences, tailoring it to their history. It's always important that we go back to history when it comes to dealing with mm-hmm. Black men, because we know that their experience from history and slavery and all of those things tells us that their struggle was definitely different from, let's say, a woman's struggle. Their struggle with like law enforcement is also another big one as well,
yeah,
right?
For sure.
And so the struggle with the law enforcement and how they have to deal with that and how they have to show up also affects just how they, you know, how they present themselves to people. So those are things that we just sort of have to be aware of when supporting them.
100%. And I liked what you said, like, we're also weak, but we're also strength. And I think there's definitely strength in being vulnerable and showing your weakness.
Absolutely. There is a lot of strength in it. I think it's you're stronger if you can show your weakness, because then in your weakness you can be made strong in it, right? Like, you can show your weakness and then through that showing of the weakness, if you have somebody who is strong in that, they can support you in strengthening that part of yourself. But if you don't show it, if you don't address it, if you don't express it, then you cannot get that support. So I feel that there is a lot of strength in being able to show weakness. And weakness doesn't mean that it's a bad thing necessarily. And I think when we use the word weakness, it connotes this like bad, horrible.
It's
not always a bad thing. Like failure, it's not always a bad thing. But when you see it, it's like, oh my God. But the truth is, for someone to succeed, failure has to show up. For someone to be strong, weakness has to show up. So like, there's a balance. And so for you to be brave, fear shows up.
You have to have those bad components in order for you to receive those good components.
Absolutely.
Or else you wouldn't be able to acknowledge that's a good component.
Absolutely. There's a balance. And so I think recognizing that both of them do show up and that there's space for both of them, I think it's not really about the terminology of strength and weakness and all of that. It's more about, okay, this is who I am. This is my identity. This is what I know about myself. And I want to be better. So what does that look like? I'm just going through that process.
Yeah. And I definitely like what you said about the need for a better assessment when it comes to Black men in particular. Mm-hmm. And I feel as though when we talk about kind of advocating for that assessment, we have Black women in the field advocating for the Black community in the assessment. Mm-hmm. But we need more Black men social workers.
We do. And they are there. I think, but I feel like, you know, where, you know, sometimes it's hard to find out where they are. A lot of them are in like other disciplines, like let's say psychotherapy, but not really like social work. They're in social work, but I feel like we need them in community spaces. We need them in organizational spaces. We need to see their faces. We need to know their names. We need to know who they are. And also, it would be good to see them as well, because when Black people are coming in and seeking support, Black men, I mean, are coming in and seeking support, representation matters, right? Mm-hmm. So you want to come in and be like, okay, that's a Black man. So kind of will know what I'm going through, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, sometimes I would, if I go into a space and I need support, I sometimes look out, like, is there a Black woman here? Because I just want to go right to her and be like, so, girl, you know? That representation matters a lot, and you can feel like yourself. You can feel like this person is my kinship. They're like my kinfolk. They will know what to do. They will know how to support me. Not necessarily, of course, but just having that already out of the way. I don't have to explain some of the other things that I'm going through. I just go right into it. I think really does help to sort of break down a lot of that barrier. And so yeah, so I understand why there's a need for like Black men to get into that social work program.
Yeah, I like what you said about like that connection, and I feel like it's even in the social practice yourself, having those colleagues that are also Black is very beneficial, because they understand the kind of burnout but also racial trauma that you experience.
Yes.
I know, like when I met Geraldine and we were just like, yep,
our first day of school.
Yes, I love it. I still have my social work friends as well, the you know, both the white ones and also the Black ones. And so when I saw some of them that are Black, we just like connect. We just connect right away, right? Mm-hmm. And so it really does help just having someone who sort of understands in a different perspective. Yeah.
So we want to kind of dive into your work in clinical social work. So what drew you to clinical social work, and what would you recommend for those planning to take this route, especially those who are currently students and taking certain classes and courses and such?
And so clinical social work, I think it came out of a drive for supporting people, right? I'm also an advocate for mental health, right? I have my mental health matters. I'm an advocate for mental health. And one of the things, of course, we've noticed in our community is that we always sort of see mental health as, or mental illness as, a taboo, right? And so for me, it's not just about the mental health, it's also about my community, being a Black woman, and coming into a space where you hear, like, you know, there's not a lot of us, there's not a lot of, like, you're a Black woman, you're a social worker, oh my goodness, like, people really, like, they're surprised when they see that, right? So,
yeah.
And so that's why we need more of us in that space. So keep coming. So that clinical aspect of things, I think it marries both the medical part, like the mental health area, and also the social part, which is like environment, community, you know, other things that go with families and all of that, resources. And so clinical social work, sort of, I feel like it's a very good process because this, as we learned in our class today, everything has to do with health, mm-hmm. right? And so we as Black people, everything we do also has to do with our health. Mm-hmm. And so coming into a space where you are a clinical social worker, you are marrying both health and the social part of it together. And so what I would recommend for those coming into this field is like to really think about like, what, first of all, your identity, who are you? What do you like? Do you like the kind of work where you are in a hospital, in a psych ward, in different spaces? Are you really interested in like health and well-being? Mm-hmm. Are you interested in like, you know, cardio and like neuro? And if those are things that you're interested in, and yet you're still also interested in social work, I feel like clinical social work helps to bridge the gap between the science and also the social, and then put it together. So that's for me, clinical social work, yeah.
All right, so our next question is, how has your experience in clinical social work shaped your perspective on the intersection of healthcare, social justice, particularly for marginalized communities?
And so I think that's a good point, and I've touched on that a little bit, that as a person of color, I'm a Black woman, and also, you know, what I would consider from like a marginalized minority group, right? We know that when it comes to systems and when it comes to support, there is still a disparity in the kind of support that Black folks receive. Right. And so and then when you're in that space, you begin to not just notice the disparities, but you also understand like why those disparities like exist. Why are these systems there? Why do these barriers exist? Well, they do because if you're using a Eurocentric Western lens in creating services for us, mm-hmm. sometimes it doesn't work, especially when you're working with an immigrant, right, who's coming in, let's say from Congo, right? Their way of doing things and the way we would do things over here is totally different, right? Mm-hmm. And when you are supporting them using that sort of Western Eurocentric lens of assessment or whatever, you find that you lose them. They're not able to understand and they don't know what you're talking about. Let's say when you're working with CAS, for example, Children's Aid Society. If I'm coming into a Congolese family and I'm bringing in my assessment on like, you know, how many kids you have, what is this, what are the this, what are the that, what is all of these things, they would be like, we don't understand some of this. What does this mean? In our way, this is the way we work, this is the way we do this. And so if it doesn't fit the chart, you find yourself like, oh, regret, oh, other, regret for this. You start othering them, putting them aside out of like what this chart is trying to say. So I think when you come in with a different frame of mind to support these individuals, I always say like, you know what, outside of your name and all of that, the rest should be blank. Just go in and just like ask questions and let them talk under your writing. Right, through that process, you really gain an understanding of who they are, how they are as a community, how they are as a group, as a family. And I'm not saying that one size fits all, because not all Congolese families are like this. They may be from like Kinshasa, so you're like, okay, what do they, how do they operate? What does their family system look like, right? And in that, you are able to then provide, hopefully, the kind of support that this family needs to integrate into the system. So maybe they need someone to help them with translation, because maybe they only have French and they don't have English, and in Ottawa you have to sort of be bilingual, so how do you support them in that process? But I think if you go in already with a preconceived like sort of idea of mm-hmm. how you want to support these individuals, you already lose them. Mm-hmm. And so the question on, like, I think you have to remind me, Jonathan, what was the question again? It just went off.
No worries. It's basically, how has that shaped your perspective with an intersection
right.
of, like, healthcare and social justice?
Exactly. So social justice part is that you're coming in without, like, already a knowledge of, like, who, like, your own knowledge of who these people are. You're allowing them to, like, be the ones to, like, talk and tell you what their stories are. And then you're coming in from that health perspective to say, you know what, these are some of the resources we have available. If your child is, let's say your child is experiencing some learning disability, these are the things that we can do. Maybe it's ADHD, these are the things that we can do, right? Okay. So just sort of knowing their story and you coming in with the support really does help bridge the gap. I said a lot.
No,
that is totally fine. You're saying everything that needs to be heard. And, like, when you talk about your experience and what you've learned, it's the raw experience of what
Absolutely.
Social work is about.
Absolutely.
I really like what you said about, I feel as though you kind of mentioned that checklist that social workers have in their head when they need to check things off.
Mm-hmm.
When in reality, those assessments, the best way to assess people is honestly having an honest conversation with them,
mm-hmm.
getting to know them before having those preconceived notions.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. One thing I've noticed is whenever I'm working with immigrants and refugees, with this question around suicide ideation, this is something that they tend to feel like they're totally jarred by when I ask that,
mm-hmm.
because especially newcomers, because it's like, these are not things we talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're just like, yeah, so any suicidal thoughts, any this, and already they're like, no, because we don't. But then it does exist with them, but maybe you don't
they see don't it understand
as, they
it,
don't
yeah.
see it as suicidal
yeah.
thoughts, or maybe they didn't know it was suicidal thoughts. So explaining it from a different perspective and coming in sort of a different way of formulating that question can, it comes with a social justice lens as well,
mm-hmm.
and also helps you support the clients and meet them where they are. Sometimes they don't understand, like, it comes back to nuances. Some of the things we say, like when we say, it's, I always use this example, it's raining cats and dogs. Sometimes people don't understand, like, they literally mean cats and dogs, like, right? But,
yeah.
But what we mean is, like,
it's just raining a lot.
Oh, exactly.
Like,
right?
Metaphors and analogies, and, like, some things we can't, they might not translate it the same way we do.
Absolutely.
They might take it literal.
Literal, exactly,
yes.
Because that's not something that is part of their language. And so you're coming in and you're like, oh, you're saying all these, like, nuances and rhetorics that they don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
You're already, like, losing them. So it's always important that we're, like, very aware of it.
And you have to come in open-minded,
really
open-minded and not closed-minded.
Exactly, right? And to really learn and listen and not come in with, like, oh, I want to show you I'm a, you know, Canadian black woman who has been here for a very long time. So, really and truly, I put that away.
So our next question, I think we're going to shift to kind of your advice
mm-hmm.
for younger social workers, particularly young black social workers. Because you kind of touched on what you need to do for clinical social work and, like, the future of social work, so
mm-hmm.
we're going to move forward. So what is your key advice for young black social workers regarding self-care? You've mentioned burnout before, and how may their taking care of themselves be unique compared to others in particular?
Mm-hmm. You know, I can't stress that so as much as I can. Like, burnout is something that is it's evident, it's prominent in our field, in social work, and then especially for marginalized or people of color or black women or whatever, because, you know, you are already going to be fighting with a system that's already against you in some ways, right? Because the systems were there 19-something, 18-something, and some of them haven't changed at all, and they're changing very little. So those times, that you were not part of the process when they made those systems, so you're going to be fighting a lot. You're going to be pushing, you're going to be, you know, advocating for your clients. And so you may possibly experience burnout, because when you put everything into it, social workers, they do that. They go in and they're like, I'm just going to find all the support. When you're doing that, you are going to be stressed out, because you will encounter a lot of systemic barriers. So self-care is super important. And self-care looks different for different communities, right? For my community, it looks totally different. It's not,
face mask.
For walks. Or face mask. Or a bubble bath. Although bubble bath is good, but I would tell you that I feel stressed when I take bubble baths because it's like, is this clean? Is this, I'm just like, I'm in a different headspace. Like,
you think
what?
It's too much.
Too much. Like, yeah. What? The water's not warm enough. It's like, what am I doing? Oh my God, I'm cold. And am I going to sleep? Oh, it's a whole mess. So, no, that's not self care. For me, self care is just hanging out with my girls. Like, you know, it's chilling. It's self care is my faith, right? Self care is my faith 100%. Self care is my partner. My partner is my self care. My self care always includes my partner and my kids. Like, that's just it.
My family's so important.
It's super important. So when people are like, oh, I just want to go away. And I'm like, I understand that. And why not? Necessary too. But even when I do go away, like I went away last weekend, but I went to Montreal to go visit my other family, my siblings and my, you know, my parents and things like that. That's another form of self-care. It's just really being around my community. And not so much isolating myself, because sometimes if I get isolated, I'm just like thinking too much and I'm in my own thoughts. I'm not really getting what I need. So, and also mindfulness looks different, right, for us too as well. Mm-hmm. Whether it's meditating or mindfulness stuff, approach, it looks different. It could be going to the mosque. It could also mean like, you know, sitting with a couple of people outside in the universe and just like doing some nice mantra that just sort of centers you back into the here and now. Mm-hmm. Self-care looks different. Sometimes self-care is a glass of wine, cooking, listening to a nice music, and just like let it be. That's self-care. Me, self-care is just opening my door and walking in and here. Hi, mommy. That's self-care.
And you're gonna talk about like how like that Western idea of like going away, the individual, but you know, there's also recognized like there is self-care and community and leading on others, which is really important.
It's so important. And that's, you know, when you are from a community, communal, collective kind of a society, self-care in an individualistic, mindset or perspective looks foreign, feels foreign, right? Mm-hmm. Like, why am I alone? Why am I alone by myself? Like, I'd rather go for a walk with like my best friend and we're walking and just talking and like, you know, whatever. Like, you know, that's self-care to me. Like, self-care is like what, like I can read a book on the beach and stuff like that. Like, oh, that's cool, but like I'd rather not. Self-care is like walking around and saying hello and like, you know, it's just doing different things. For me, self-care is not just sort of sitting on myself. It's being with people.
It's environment, especially like when you surround yourself with people who make you feel good. Mm-hmm. That's genuinely caring for inside.
Absolutely.
Surrounding yourself in environment is so important.
It's so important. I would say self-care because it's so like it's the self, but self-care is not just self. Self-care is others, like supporting others sometimes is self-care. Mm-hmm. And so it's important that we look at that. And one thing I wanted to mention around self-care as well is that we are always told to take care of ourselves, take care of ourselves, take care of ourselves. And then what happens is that you're trying to take care of yourself, but the organization you work at isn't helping, isn't supporting you in taking care of yourself as well. So self-care is not just an individual or a community thing. It's a system of things. It's an organizational sort of mandate. Yeah, that's it.
So you touched on our next question.
Oh, really?
So I'll just get to the last one. What advice would you give your younger self during your bachelor years that you wish you had known back then? And I know this one's probably a bit deep because you're thinking like, what was I doing?
I would say, I was getting this nudge like to go get into social work longer before I got into it. So if I, my younger self, I would have said go in then when you got that first nudge because you would have really enjoyed it. But anyways, I also like the path that I took as well. So that's probably one of the advice I give my younger self. And I think one of the most important thing is that network, know people, get to know people, right? And preserve those friendships because you will definitely need them. And it's hard now to make friends as an adult, but when you're quite young and like 18, 19, 20, whatever, like, making friends is a little easier, right? And so I would say nurture those friendships. That's what I would have said to myself. Yeah, nurture those friendships.
That's really nice. Like, mm-hmm. you know, when you
nurture this friendship.
Don't worry. So we're gonna do a firing of like questions. We're gonna do a this or that. Okay. And they are going to be social work based questions. So sure. it's gonna be like, we're gonna ask one question and be like this or that, and you just go with whatever your heart tells you to go with.
Yeah. All right, so first one, community work or hospital work?
Community work.
Okay.
One-on-one counseling or group therapy?
Group therapy.
Okay. Advocacy or direct intervention?
Advocacy, for sure.
And then long-term cases or crisis response?
Crisis response. I like drama.
Oh.
Crisis response.
All right.
I like the drama.
She's
next to
the drama.
Okay. Working with youth or working with elders?
I know this one's a hard one, but I actually this one's a hard working with the youth. Mm-hmm. I know what it feels like. I don't know what it feels like to be an elder, so that's always harder for me, but I like I know what it's like to be a youth, so yeah.
So policy change or grassroots activism?
Grassroots, all the way.
Emotional resilience or strong boundaries?
Strong boundaries. Emotional resilience is not, like, I understand it, but like it depletes you, it weathers you.
It can strain you more.
Yes, emotionally. Like and it's also perpetuating this same narrative around strong Black women. That's emotional resilience.
Yeah.
And, well, you know, I am a Black woman, I am strong, but I also can be weak as well. So I need my boundaries.
You need those weak moments.
Mm-hmm.
Street outreach or office-based support?
Both.
Okay.
Self-care days or professional development days?
Professional development days. I don't know. I like self-care, but like after professional development, I can go and do self-care. But self-care sometimes is just like, what am I supposed to do with myself?
You have to think heavy.
Yeah.
You have to be like, so
what do I do with all this time?
Yeah, and that in itself is stressful. I'm like, should I go to walk? Should I go to the gym?
My mind is everywhere.
Everywhere. So I was like, so instead you're telling me to go and do this workshop, and I can do that.
Mm-hmm.
I can, especially if you have paid for it, I can do it. So
more
yeah.
direct.
It's more exactly, direct. Exactly. So yeah.
And then last one, challenging systemic barriers or navigating bureaucracy?
Challenging systemic barriers. Navigating bureaucracy, yes, it may seem easier right now and everything, but I just feel like that requires a lot of, you know, talking up to people and, you know, sort of, you know, pandering to them just to get what you want and things like that. Sometimes that can be tiring. It is really tiring to do the systems one, but I think that because of the work that's already been done, it's always good to just continue to champion it so that we can continue to see the changes that are happening already. And so the bureaucracy one, someone else can take care of it.
All right. Well, that was the last of our questions. We are so happy that you're able to come in and answer all these questions, and I hope that someone was able to take what you've said and apply it to their career, whether they're going to social work or whether it could help them within their career of their choice. But very grateful that you came in and you answered all the questions amazingly.
Yes, thank you so much. And I hope like this episode, the way you talk about the Black community and how we interact, will get other social workers inspired to continue learning.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's just one voice. There's so many more voices out
Absolutely.
There, especially.
Absolutely. And I thank you, Kayla, and I thank you, Geraldine. This was really good. I was kind of nervous. I was just like, oh my goodness, I'm going to be talking about myself and it's going to be out there. But I do enjoy talking about myself too. And if it's going to inspire someone, then I feel like I've done my job. Even if it's just that one person, I feel like I've done my job. And I really do love my work. And I encourage those who are doing it to really get into it as well. I encourage people to explore different avenues, right? Like, especially when you're starting, don't sit in one space. Like, if you're going to be in the hospital, do it in the hospital, then go and, you know, work in community, then go and work in an addiction center, then go and, you know, go out to the streets, then, you know, do different things, go to the office, like go to the government, work in different spaces. And I think a lot of times for security reasons, we tend to like find a space or we stay there, which is great. But then what we then notice is that people experience more burnout and also you know, the joy of being in that job also sort of starts to go down. You're not so excited anymore, nothing really pushes you, and you start to look for something else. And then by the time you leave, you find that others have sort of gone further ahead than you would have. So that's why I always say explore different areas so you find where your niche is, and you can go into that space. And I feel like one thing doesn't work for me. I'm not a one girl kind of girl. Yeah. I do a lot of different things because sitting still doesn't sort of work for me. Mm-hmm. And so if you're that type of person, then find out what works for you and just figure it out. And if you're a sort of one approach kind of person, that's okay as well. But find out one thing that you really love to do, because if you really enjoy it, you will have longevity in your career, right? Mm-hmm. And so, because social workers tend to experience a lot of burnout, and then halfway through their career, they're out of it, they're doing something else, and we're losing social workers. So, yeah.
And that's the beauty of really social work, kind of, like how broad it is.
Absolutely, how broad it is. And, you know, that's one something I was just going to add, that that's one thing that's different from from other disciplines like psychology, psychotherapy, counseling, whatever. Like, they do like the mental illness stuff, pathologizing, labeling, and all that. We can do that. And we can support you with resources, with management of your cases, with your families, with your community, with your environment. We go in other aspects. It's a holistic approach that social worker brings. The social workers bring to the forefront, while others only sort of bring one or two lens into that space. So social workers, we really have a lot of power in our space. And so I think it's important to know that, and it's important to utilize that in whatever we're doing.
Perfect.
So that is the end of our first episode of
Stories of Service.
Thank you very much. If you guys are interested in learning more or continue watching our episodes, stay tuned on the Bachelors of Social Work Student Society's Instagram page, where this will be posted. And we hope that you guys had a great Black History Month, as well as not only Black History Month is in February, but it's 365 days of the year.
It surely is.
So,
and more.
And more. So keep learning, and we'll see you guys next time.